From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. When news first broke that President Trump talked to the new Ukrainian president about investigating Joe Biden, Trump, unsurprisingly, took to his favorite medium, Twitter, to fire back.
A controversy, tweeting, quote, "Now that the Democrats and the fake news media have gone bust on every other of their witch hunt schemes, they are trying to start one just as ridiculous as the others, calling it the Ukraine witch hunt, while at the same time trying to protect sleepy Joe Biden. Will fail again."
You know, we've seen this play out before. Trump attacks the media as spewing fake news or claiming alternative facts, which can drown out negative news coverage. But attacking the media isn't the only way Trump uses social media. Since first launching his presidential campaign, Trump has fired off countless tweet storms that are often so outrageous, they become the leading news story. Think about the height of the summer. Trump tweeted that four congresswomen of color, known collectively as the Squad, should go back to where they came from.
Who tweeted Sunday they should
go back and help
to their
fix
home.
The totally broken
and crime-infested places from which they came.
A week or so later, Trump called the city of Baltimore a, quote, "disgusting rat and rodent-infested mess." Trump remains unapologetic about those tweets. Here at Reveal, we held a big staff meeting to talk about how the media was covering Trump. And many of us agreed, myself included, that his tweets about the congresswomen were racist. We also talked about how the media pivots away from other big stories when Trump fires up his Twitter feed. My colleague, Will Carlos, has been taking a look at the stories that have been buried and largely forgotten, and he joins me now. Hey, Will.
Hey, Al.
So let's go back to July when President Trump tweeted about the Squad in Baltimore. What else was going on in the news?
It was a pretty disastrous week for the Trump administration. I mean, for example, you had a big poll coming out saying that Trump was trailing his Democratic rivals. You had Trump's labor secretary having a step down after it was revealed that he was heavily involved in creating a plea deal for sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. It was the same week. Do you remember that disastrous visit by the vice president, Pence, to the detention facility in Texas where he's kind of touring it? It was supposed to be a photo op and it was just a disaster for him. So there's all this like negative, embarrassing stuff happening at the same time. But you and I both know what we were all talking about, right?
Yeah, the latest tweet storm. So you went back and looked over the president's Twitter feed. What did you find?
Right, well, again and again and again, we saw the same pattern play out. There's some negative or embarrassing news story that starts to break and immediately gets hidden by just an offensive or an outrageous tweet that the president sends, and then the media endlessly discusses.
So back to the tweets about the Squad. During that time, was there one issue that really got overshadowed?
So this is really the best example that we found of a story that should have gotten a lot more attention than it did. The president had just vetoed bipartisan bills that would have limited the sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia to be used in the ongoing war in Yemen.
It's a lot more of a complicated story to follow than what Trump is stirring up on his Twitter feed, but it's a really important story.
Yeah, it definitely is. And now in recent weeks, Yemen has gotten a lot more attention. That's after a minority group there called the Houthis took credit for bombing a Saudi oil field, which knocked out half of the kingdom's oil output. And that meant people were worried about whether their gas prices in the U.S. are going to go up. But, you know, back in July, this story was not getting a lot of traction.
Right. So now we're going to dedicate some time to it. Will, you've been spending the last couple of weeks digging into the story. What have you found?
Well, I've been interviewing folks who've been following this all along. And one of those people's a journalist called Rawan Shaif, who's been to Yemen several times to cover the conflict, and she lived there for a while.
It's almost like screaming into a void, and that was what it was like reporting on Yemen and working on these airstrikes.
Rawan is now based in London, and she leads the coverage at Bellingcat, an online investigative site. She's really good at breaking down the conflict and how it's changed.
What the conflict is now is incredibly different to what it was 4 to 5 years ago. Different allies, the shift in allegiances, all of that has drastically changed over the course of the conflict. But it is always incredibly good to start right at the beginning in order to understand how polarized this conflict is. So in 2011, protesters all across the country in Yemen called for the ousting of Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had been a president for 33 years. They did so successfully, and by 2012, he signed off to his deputy, Hadi, who is now the president of Yemen, to take his place. Now, one would have assumed that this transition would have been peaceful. However, it was anything but that.
So that was during the Arab Spring. And the next big development was that there was this huge rift between Hadi, the new president who is backed by Saudi Arabia, and the Houthis, who have support from Iran. The Houthis are fighting for a religious minority group who they say are being discriminated against. Well, that rift between the Houthis and the new president quickly kind of metastasized into something much broader. It changed from a civil war to a conflict with a lot of influence from outside players.
Especially given the attack on the oil facility in Saudi Arabia, I think it's becoming more and more a proxy war. It wasn't a proxy war when this first all began.
So yeah, at this point, the two big players are Saudi Arabia on one side, backed by the US, and the Houthis on the other side.
This is what makes the conflict in Yemen incredibly difficult to report on. All these minuscule changes that require a lot of context and a lot of background knowledge in order to understand their significance in the current moment.
Just to understand this correctly, the United States is mainly involved by supplying weapons and logistics. We don't have any troops on the ground or anything like that.
Yeah, that's right. And that's probably one of the reasons why this hasn't sort of taken root so strongly as a story in America. But, you know, we are providing the bombs that are killing people. Since 2015, the US has been supporting the Saudi-led coalition with things like targeting assistance and, at least until recently, mid-air refueling. You've got companies like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin that are supplying the bombs that are heading to the conflict. And Rawan Shaif has actually seen evidence of that firsthand.
So one of my main roles when I was in Yemen was to document sites where airstrikes had occurred to an evidentiary standard. And out of the 113 that I investigated, about 80 of them had a US munition tied to them. And that alone always gives me the ability to sort of speak to the US's involvement in this.
So I want to note a couple of things here. First of all, this wasn't originally Trump's war. He basically inherited this situation from the Obama administration. And the US says it has legitimate reasons to be involved in this conflict. Now, Yemen's long been a hotbed for terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. And so the US has been providing arms and support to Saudi Arabia for more than 4 years. What's most concerned American lawmakers is that those bombs have just been used pretty indiscriminately. The Saudis have, whether by accident or on purpose, bombed everything from hospitals to apartment buildings to school buses, all using American-made weapons.
You talk to some people both in Yemen and with close ties to the country. So how is this war affecting daily life?
This has really transformed life in Yemen. And one way of telling this story and kind of just how much the country has changed is to think about weddings.
Yeah, so my last trip, I was 16, I was a teenager. It was summertime, it was wedding season.
So that's Jihan Hakim, who's the co-chair of the Yemeni-American Alliance here in the San Francisco Bay Area. She was born in the US, but she visited Yemen regularly growing up.
Weddings in Yemen go on for about a week, and every day it's a different outfit, and dancing in the streets, fireworks, people out until the middle of the night, stores shut down, block parties, kids, food, music. It was just a ball.
Well, that, of course, was before the war. And things today look very different. Joyous occasions like weddings have actually been attacked in airstrikes.
Whole families were killed. Whole families. I'm talking about hundreds of families. Whole families. Everyone is killed.
That's Nasser Arabi. He's a local journalist and filmmaker who we reached in Sana'a, the country's constitutional capital. He's covered this conflict for the New York Times and other publications.
They bomb you while you are in the middle of the wedding, killing the bride and bridegroom and everyone. All, everyone. This is what happened. This is what it's like. And also funerals, when you are carry the dead body to the grave with hundreds of people gathering, and reciting Quran, Saudi Arabia came and bombed them.
And all this violence has other consequences. The UN says that up to 20 million people are dying of starvation in Yemen because of the impact of the war. They say it's the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet. Here's Jehan Hakim again. She's the Yemeni-American activist here in the Bay Area.
You know, if we were to look at a conference hall, for example, and there are 100 people in this conference room, 75% of these people do not have anything to eat. And then if we multiply that times the population of Yemen, which is a little over 22 million people, 75% of Yemen's population are in need of humanitarian assistance right away. And nearly half of those that are in need are children. So I know it feels like something that's so distant and far away, and we just look at numbers and statistics, but it's drastic and the need is dire.
Okay, so we started out talking about President Trump vetoing these bills to limit arms sales to Saudi Arabia. How much has Congress done to try and intervene?
You know, there have been some efforts in Congress to make an impact. And those were like the couple of times where if we were going to talk about Yemen, we would talk about it when two specific bills were being discussed and voted on. A big one was this bipartisan bill basically to pull the USA out of the Yemen conflict completely back in April.
This is important because Yemen faces still a potential famine of millions of people, the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
That's Ro Khanna, the congressman who introduced that first bill.
And the conflict in Yemen is one of the greatest sources of tension in the Middle East. So solving the war in Yemen would do a lot to bringing greater peace to the Middle East. And the fact that the Congress came together to pass Senator Sanders and my war powers resolution to stop a war should have led on the front page of every newspaper.
But this wasn't on the front page of every newspaper.
Right. I mean, far from it. In this case, it didn't really matter because President Trump ended up vetoing the bill right after it was passed. And as we said before, in July, he went on to veto three other bills that would have banned more than $8 billion in arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
Normally, when the president vetoes a bill, it gets a lot of attention. And the media did cover the vetoes, but that kind of got lost in the news cycle.
Right. I mean, there really wasn't a whole lot of public awareness about this. And one of the big reasons why people might have missed this news is that it coincided with Donald Trump either tweeting or saying something that was either racist or hurtful or insulting, which basically just took over the news cycle.
Today, the president tweeted about Cummings' Baltimore district. It reads, quote, "Cummings district is a disgusting rat and rodent infested mess."
So I distinctly remember the Baltimore tweets.
That's journalist Rawan Shaif again.
That Trump had posted right around the time that other bills were trying to be passed to veto the sales of arms to Saudi Arabia, and how that was basically picked up more so in the news. And it is incredibly frustrating when tweet storms do take that place.
It just seems to me that this keeps happening whenever bad news is coming down the pike for the administration. And it just seems too much to be a coincidence is what I'm trying to get at.
I mean, look, Trump has issued five vetoes since he took power. Four of those five vetoes have been vetoes of legislation that was agreed on by a Congress that can't agree about anything, that was agreed on by both Republicans and Democrats, that was sent to his desk, and he vetoed them. And right at the same time, there's this big brouhaha about something else, and that story gets completely buried. We can't say that it's purposeful, but there is certainly, like, where there's smoke, there's fire.
So both of those bills have been vetoed. Is it safe to say that we are still lending support to the war in Yemen?
Because of those vetoes, yes, we are. I mean, that support has reduced somewhat. We're no longer, for example, refueling Saudi airplanes in midair, and that's something that came out of the bill that was passed in April. But we are still, I mean, we're in the process of selling Saudi Arabia and its allies more than $8 billion worth of weapons that will probably end up being used in Yemen.
Those are some pretty dire consequences.
I mean, basically, things just keep getting worse in Yemen, or at the very least, they don't get any better. Here's Yemeni-American activist Jihan Hakim again.
It's frustrating because we want the stories of the impacted highlighted so maybe Americans will think about it. Americans will care about it. Americans will want to do something about it. It is extremely hard sitting in different congressional visits, showing pictures of children's body parts all over the place and trying to capture the impact in words and in images and it being kind of not taken seriously. And then the media does the same thing.
I asked Yemeni journalist Nasser Arabi as well, like if he walked out of the room where he was talking to me from, what does he see? And here's what he said.
You can see the misery in the eyes of the people who were displaced, who left their houses and came to Sana'a. They are in slums. They are in a very bad places. They are in unfinished buildings. They are in some schools. So we are talking about millions of people left their homes.
I can't help but think that years from now, we're going to look back at this and we're going to have to be called into account for not bearing witness and doing something about this. So I guess my question for you is, what's the media's responsibility and what can we do?
I mean, I'd like to think that we're at that sort of moment of realization like now, that we're looking at it and we're saying, hey, wait a minute, are we playing their game? Are we looking at all the wrong stuff? And that was kind of the point, was to go back and really dig into the stories that we missed. And this was, you know, we thought the most important one. And you're right. I mean, we have a responsibility to pay attention to this stuff because it has a real impact. And that's what Rowan Shaif told me.
If you remember in 2018, when the school bus in Sada was hit by the Saudi-led coalition, and it was a bus carrying children after a field trip, there was a lot of press coverage about that particular incident. Everyone from CNN to the New York Times to the Washington Post to MSNBC to even Fox News had covered it. And when everyone had written about this particular strike, and also that was a strike where US munition had been used and was well documented, you saw that actually the Saudis, they took accountability for that strike because media played such a huge role in it. People in Congress were starting to speak up. People in Parliament in the UK were starting to speak up. And it was one of the very few strikes where that had happened.
The Saudis took responsibility for it and said, yeah, we shouldn't have done that and we're going to investigate it. So we see that when something gets attention in the media, it can lead to some real action, which is why it's doubly frustrating for people involved in this conflict when the media doesn't give this important issue the time that it needs.
And this is just one of the stories that's been overlooked, and this took a lot of time to dig into. What else could we be missing?
I mean, I guess we don't know until we go looking. As you said earlier, it's important to cover when Trump is tweeting something racist or when he crosses boundaries. Of course it is. But I think we should all kind of have a warning light goes off in our heads. That when we see the latest, greatest controversial statement, we should also be looking in the corners and looking behind that and seeing what the stories are that we could be missing too.
Will Carlos, thanks for talking to me.
Thanks, Al.
President Trump expresses a lot of opinions on Twitter, but he's remained relatively quiet about the QAnon conspiracy theory that portrays him as something of a superhero in a fight against the deep state.
The Trump administration has never done anything to significantly distance itself from QAnon in any way. In fact, Donald Trump's Twitter account has retweeted or quote tweeted QAnon accounts more than 25 times.
That's coming up on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Reveal sponsors include LD Entertainment and Roadside Attractions, presenting Judy, starring Renee Zellweger as Judy Garland. 30 years after she shot to stardom in The Wizard of Oz, Judy arrives in London for a tumultuous run of sold-out shows. Now playing in theaters.